Hello and welcome to another episode of Breaking Mayberry, the show that has been nipped in the bud one last time. I'm one of your hosts, I'm Marty Schneider.
I'm the other host, Dan Ludwig.
And we come here to bury Barney Fife, not to praise him.
He's to tell the story of a complicated man slash complete bastard.
It's not that complicated. Not that complex. Yeah.
Actually, that's the right, least complicated folks. Man ever.
This is our Don Knotts send-off episode. As we've noted, we have reached the point of the Andy Griffith Show where Don Knotts is no longer a main character. He will appear as a recurring character in basically guest appearances from here on out. But he gone. We got no more Barney. You don't have Barney Fife to kick around anymore. And we're doing a send-off for Don Knotts, which is more than the Andy Griffith Show fucking did.
Insane that he gets as much of a send-off as fucking Ellie. Like, yeah.
He disappears. There are two episodes left in season 5 that we'll cover in the next episode, but Don Knotts is not in them, and all they say is he's away. He's gone. He's off doing his thing. So that's it. They essentially just ship him off. He's like that one other brother who bounces the basketball in the first episode of Happy Days and then is just shipped off to Korea, I guess.
Or the sister from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air that goes up the stairs and never comes back down.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So, and that's what they're doing to Don Knotts, the second lead of the show.
Which I take to mean that they were like, until the absolute last second, they were pretty sure they were getting him back.
Yeah,
they were like,
that's one
theory. He would never do that. And then he bounced.
I think he definitely would do that, because we're going to talk about some movies that he made today, like with parts of the Andy Griffith Show writing room as kind of his, like, I'm getting out of here ticket.
Yeah.
Now, because of my weird search history, I do get like recommendations from MeTV. And recently I read an article from MeTV about the history where Don Knotts once said that his leaving the show was just a misunderstanding. He thought that Andy was going to end it. And if he had known that Andy was going to continue for another couple of years, he would have stayed on. And I think that is bullshit.
Yeah.
lie.
No fucking. Yeah. I would have made the worst business decision of my entire fucking life. It was just a misunderstanding.
Yeah. Because
he just, after this, printed money.
For a couple of years. Yeah.
Yeah. He was in certifiable hits. And then after that, as we've discussed with Gus, a long tale of just being able to slap his face on whatever and make a cool, like some walking around money from it.
Until the late 70s and early 80s, when he returns to television with Three's Company. And listen, we've talked a lot about Don Knotts playing a dipshit cop. I don't think we've talked enough about the fact that his other most famous role is a fucking landlord.
Yeah.
We should hate this guy. We should hate this guy deeply.
I mean, this is the first time that we've really watched something where he has been Don Knotts' protagonist, just protagonist, and not a football coach or a virgin playboy or a fucking fish fucker. So this is just him. It is Don Knotts, human man who is goofy, and it is very weird to not be like, hey man, what's your fucking deal, to Don, like, which is what most of the world knows him as, is like, yeah, it's Don Knotts. He's a guy that is in a movie where he sees like too many dogs and he's like, what's going on around here? Like, yeah. So where it this felt very uncanny to like, I kept getting mad at him and being like, yeah, you would say that, Barney. Oh, right. Yeah, no, you're just a man.
We are covering two Don Knotts movies today. But first, separation of man, like you just said, there's the man and there's the character. First, let's do our official Breaking Mayberry send-off to the character of Barney Fife. Dan, would you like to explain how we are going to send him off? And I'm going to play the Manhunt theme.
So, our thinking for the best way to send off Barney Fife is to do our top five crimes of Barney Fife. The things that he did on this show that we think are the most reprehensible, upsetting, horrible, bad. The worst shit he's done on the show that has made us the angriest and has hung with us the longest. So that is our 21 gun salute to this horrible fucking character. And I think the way we're going to do it is we're going to go number one. I'm going to say my number one. You say your number one.
Well, we got to start at five, right?
Oh, you want to start at five and work our way up.
Five and work our way up. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right, so I'll start with my number five.
Number five.
The Jinx, the episode where he gets a man ostracized from town by telling everybody that he has bad luck. As a refresher, a guy who's just around watches Barney play checkers. Barney loses at the game of checkers, and out of revenge, blames it on the guy, claiming that he is unlucky, and so his presence made him lose, and then whips the town into a frenzy about how unlucky this man is, to the point where he is, like, not only almost driven out of town, but also God kind of gets in on it. Like, he kind of talks God into this dude being unlucky. And then he becomes unlucky. Like, Barney bullies a guy so hard that reality changes.
He bends existence. Yeah, he causes luck to be real. He causes the world luck to exist. That's a pretty solid one. That's a pretty good one. So I did a list basically of, like, the Barney Fife things, the things that he's done that maybe not the most, like, illegal or reprehensible, but the things that have hurt me the most, have attacked me, Marty Schneider, the most. And this first one, number five, might be controversial, might be actually a little bit presumptuous.
Mm-hmm.
But my number five, the number five worst thing that Barney Fife did on this show is Leave It. Leaving. I'm making Leaving my number five. And the reason for this is because, like, as much as we've complained about this character, as much as we've been like, what the hell is this guy's whole deal? Every time he's off screen, every time Don Knotts disappears, takes a week off, and they say Barney Fife is off having gay sex at the YMCA in Raleigh,
mm-hmm.
the show is untenable. The fucking the replacements that they bring in are always awful. The show fundamentally does not work without him there. And there are three fucking seasons for us to sit through without him. So
it is
things that have attacked me and you. Number five, Leaving.
The evil that exists within him has to, like, it's like when you kill, like, Dracula in a TV show, and then the spirit, Dracula's evil, has to embody someone else. It's like the dark cloud leaves him and just goes into, like, fucking Aunt B for an episode. And
you
now
thought
she's
that was the final boss.
Yeah, she like somebody else becomes infected with the spirit of Fife for 22 minutes.
All right. Number four. What's your four?
Yeah. All right. My number four, when he tried to kill several dogs, when he barely made the decision to not kill, I'm going to say 15 dogs.
So many dogs.
So many dogs.
He almost committed canicide, like, so many times.
The station had too many dogs. They accidentally got way too many dogs. And they took Barney, when nobody was looking, took those dogs, put them in a car, and then put them in an empty field out in the middle of nowhere and then drove away. And then a lightning
That's a crime.
Yeah.
That's animal abandonment. That's a felony. I'm sorry. I can't keep yelling. That's a crime. Because they all are. Right.
Yeah. But there are. And best case scenario, a thunderstorm doesn't happen and kill all the dogs. But under those circumstances, now there's a pack of feral dogs just right. running around. Definitely like. Becoming increasingly famished and probably dangerous.
Rabid, so, like, right? Like, one of those dogs is definitely going to get bit by a raccoon, and then a lot of bad things are going to happen.
So, like, that suddenly those kids are just dragging an 8-year-old off into the woods to feast on his carcass. And you did, but that's the best case scenario. Really, those dogs were going to die.
Right. No.
And he would have definitely left them there if a child hadn't almost cried at him. He was fully ready to let those dogs freeze to death in a thunderstorm.
All right, my number four, things that Barney Fife has done that I hated.
Mm-hmm.
Going down to the filling station for a soda.
Yeah.
Going to Thelma Lou's to watch some TV and take a nap. That's right. That's what he's going to do. He's going to go down to the filling station, get a soda, get a pop, go to Thelma Lou's for some TV, take a nap. Yes, sirree. That's what he's going to do. Go to the filling station for a pop and then to Thelma Lou's.
You know,
to watch some TV.
You know how in Guantanamo Bay...
Take a nap.
God damn you.
Oh my God, that bit. That bit. Yeah. And they've done it two or three times. Two or three times. They made this a giant joke out of him repeating that sentence over and over and over again for longer than was necessary. And I hated it. I hate it so much. It wasn't funny. It didn't play to anyone's strengths. It wasn't...
It's the SNL thing of you tell a joke, you keep telling a joke over and over and over again, so it stops being funny, and then it becomes so unfunny that it becomes funny again. But it wasn't funny to begin with,
never
so
funny.
Doing it for way too long can't come back because it was dumb from the first syllable.
Number three, Dan, what you got?
Number three, and this is ranked... shockingly low for me. I'm consolidating a lot of stuff down. Cheating on Thelma Lou.
Mm-hmm.
And generally the way he treats Thelma Lou.
Mm-hmm.
Which the cheating on Thelma Lou has mystified me more than anything, just because it's still so crazy that was on TV. But also the thing he does in The Farmer's Wife, where Barney's big, mean friend tries to basically capture Thelma Lou like he's King Kong and just take her off into the wilderness. And Barney's reaction to this is to call Thelma Lou a slut.
Yeah.
Yeah. And say, like, you weren't resisting him hard enough, you harpy. So generally, the way he has trapped this poor woman in a cage of neglect and abuse, and then just doesn't, and then fucks somebody else.
And you know, there's the one time when Thelma, like, actually stood up for herself and said, the one time she really got mad was when she heard him say that he doesn't have to worry about her. He's got her wrapped around his finger. Like, he basically just says, that bitch always gonna be here. And she finds out about it, and she gets mad about it. And he talks his way back and then learns nothing, right? Ends the episode with saying, yeah, she gonna be there no matter what. This, I think, is only shaved, and this is why I think you should put it at three. I think you made the right call. It's only shaved off by the fact that Thelma Lou herself sucks, man. Thelma Lou is also, like, she doesn't deserve what's going to her. Like, nobody deserves to be in this kind of relationship. But also, as a person, she's also just kind of terrible, man.
She has so many... That door opens so many times that she can walk through, and she never does.
And, #justice for Thelma Lou.
Yeah. I will say, in regards to the infidelity, I have been reading a lot of Agatha Christie lately and watching a lot of Cary Grant movies. And I think I've come to the conclusion that, man, dudes cheating on their girlfriends and or wives was just way more chill than I even fathomed. I knew from like Mad Men that like it happened a lot, but I didn't know that when a guy got caught doing it, it was basically like, Craig, oh, I didn't have time. You rascal, knock it off.
This really upsets me, but legally I can't have a bank account without your name on it, so I guess I got a deal.
God,
only Craig. One of us can have a credit card.
Girl's gonna say, Craig, no, you can't. I'm not gonna say you better stop it because I know you won't, but Craig, like, it's just like there. I've just read like three books where the whole thing is like, oh yeah, this guy's cheating on his wife. No, it's bad, but it's not like that big of a deal.
So because of where you've ranked this, I'm actually gonna swap my number three and my number two, because it goes into it. My number three now, rubbing it through the pants at the office. The constant phone sex and getting half boners and just rubbing, just jerking it behind his desk at the office.
Yeah. I forgot that he kind of cranks it a couple of times.
Remember, like we never see him with Juanita. We never see Juanita at all. All we see him is him calling Juanita and just like dirty talking her and through the whole time and just kind of saying, yeah, we're going to go out tonight. I'm going to take you out, you know, to the duck pond and look at the ducks. And he's just halfway rubbing just through there. And that's what happens every single time. He gets a little halfway hard and Andy comes in and he's like, oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. I'm doing it now. The elbow is just making a slow motion and he's rubbing his leg, I think. But yeah, it's inner thigh. He's doing a lot of inner thigh rubbing at a slow pace. He's cranking it. I forgot he masturbates in the office on a pretty regular basis.
I think we figured this out once, is that like the sheriff's office is probably the only part in town that has a private line.
Yeah.
Everything else has a party line, right? Mm. There was one episode where like two women were having a discussion about like foot funguses, and that shut down the entire town for like half a day. So yeah. I think that's why he does it at the office, is because it's the only way that he has a private line. I think we figured that out once. Yeah. On the taxpayer's dime, ladies and gentlemen.
In a building regularly attended by a boy.
By a child, yeah.
Yeah, by a little kid who's like, hi, everybody, I'm here learning what it is to be an adult. And every time I go, like, oh!
All right, number two.
Opie, don't come hug me.
Wasn't gonna! Don't worry about it.
Yeah. That bridge has been burned a long time ago.
All right, Dan, what's your number two?
All right. The classic, I would say. Arrests the whole town multiple times. I think three.
Has to be.
And then consistently makes them apologize for it. Because the way that the town does not appreciate being arrested hurts his feelings. So Andy makes everybody say what a good special boy he is. And very importantly, the thing that stops him from arresting the whole town is Andy coming home. So I'm not saying that they would have starved in that jail if Andy had never come back, but we don't have the evidence that it would have ended there.
I mean, I can prove that. He arrests Aunt B. That's the woman responsible for feeding the prisoners.
Yeah, that's true. He has cut off their food source.
The cafeteria lady's in jail.
If you needed to like lay siege to Mayberry, like if I'm doing like a Die Hard-esque siege where I'm trying to take down that town, you capture Aunt B.
Yeah.
The town's neutralized. They've lost their food source. You've got them. They're immediately going to have to surrender. Without her fried chicken, without her incredibly bland fried chicken, they're dead within a week.
Taking out Aunt B is like shooting a medic. It's considered a war crime.
Like, yes. But yeah, so he regularly arrests the whole town, and then it's always their fault for being arrested. They don't even get to be mad at him for being totalitarianismed.
My number what two, which was my number three, totalitarianism is a fun verb. My number two, which was my number three until just now. This one isn't his fault, but fuck him. Having a cousin named Virgil and introducing us to his fucking cousin Virgil. Virgil, you might remember, is basically the same character as the Jinx character. He's just a clumsy dude who breaks everything and then kind of responds to everything in an uncomfortable voice as like a sexy, dumb baby.
Oh, yeah. Was that me? Oh, did I do that? And then he kind of pouts a little bit. Like, you know, just made me deeply uncomfortable. And it's Barney Fife's fault that we had to deal with that guy for an entire episode. And he makes my skin crawl. I hate it. So I'm going to blame Barney for that.
Yeah. Just, right. I think the crimes of him there are not killing Virgil when they were children and bringing him and allowing him to come and not killing him when he tried to come to town.
In fairness, he doesn't want Virgil there either. But
yeah,
all right. And then number one, should we just say it together? I think we definitely have the same number one, right?
All right. It's the motorcycle.
It's right? The fucking motorcycle.
Yeah, right?
It's the fucking motorcycle.
And everything it represents about him, where the slightest increase to his stats, like, just immediately goes straight to town misery. Like if he gets a plus one to agility, and that is immediately reflected in how unhappy every single resident is.
I have now seen this motorcycle in person. Mm-hmm. I have visited this motorcycle, and the evil emanating off of this prop. Like, I walked past it and it's got a chill. Like, ooh. Like seeing a painting by Hitler, right? Like,
It feels like it's
innocuous, but it's like, oh no, there's some bad vibes off of that.
It is the most like fascist prop, right? Like that episode was evil in a way that we truly grappled with, where we were like, they talk about killing him like he's a Nazi, and it is like he terrorizes it. He unleashes a reign of terror upon this poor populace.
I'll give a preview. The guest we're bringing in for the next episode, the guest we're working with right now, is a biographer of the Andy Griffith Show. Andy Griffith himself. His name is Evan Dalton Smith. And in one of his introductions, Evan mentions that, like, it's interesting that a lot of the writers from the Andy Griffith Show were guys who came back from World War II. They just got back from fighting fascists. Like, they just got, and they created a character that is fascism incarnate, but made him like a useless, inept, impotent little bitch, basically. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how much I buy that theory. I think some of the writers are in on the joke and some of them are not. And then, of course, this backfires because it sort of normalizes the fascism to America. America see this dipshit fascist cop and they're like, okay, well, we don't have to worry about it because they're all inept little Barney Fife morons.
Yeah. You
know? So it sort of backfires in this. I can see this. I think that some writers are in on the joke and some of them aren't. But in this episode, the motorcycle episode, it's the most obvious. Like, this is, they mean it. They 100% mean it. Plus, anytime they play that fucking theme, which I'm going to be playing this entire time. So it is well known. But I think you got a little bit of Archie Bunker syndrome there, where like the character just backfires and does not get the message they're supposed to. It's the motorcycle. The motorcycle is the worst. Also, I didn't put it in there because I didn't remember what episode, but there is definitely discussion of Barney taking lessons in karate or something from, quote, an old German soldier, which made me pause and record scratch and go, an old what now? Soldier?
Yeah.
Barn?
Yeah, there was always some weird Nazi association stuff with him. But I think, so, in terms of the resonance of a weird little fascist freak, I think it was the show was actually kind of too ahead of its times, because because of another much better podcast that I listened to, I just watched The Crimes of Anthony Pelicano, who, if you're not familiar, was a Hollywood fixer in the 90s. He was a private investigator who wiretap. Basically, his only move was that he would wiretap people's phones. Like, if you were a Hollywood producer that was going through a divorce, he would wiretap your ex-wife.
And is he the guy that got McTiernan in trouble?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and I was watching his thing, and the motherfucker was eerily similar to Barney Fife in that he was like a little, he was an absolute fucking doofus. Just this little pipsqueak who was always talking about how he was a badass Sicilian and like acting like a tough guy. And everybody just kind of tolerated him. And he just had this fucking reign of terror. And if you like met him, you'd be like, this is the biggest fucking doofus. And he is poses no harm whatsoever. And it kind of like, then you see like, oh no, a guy like this, like if you are just an asshole who is tolerated by society within you can just do vast amounts of damage.
Honestly, so much of the current right wing is just populated by absolute dipshits.
Yeah.
Who, like, you would laugh at if you spoke to them in person, but they have accumulated so much power partially because we've just dismissed them as absolute fucking weenie dipshits.
Yeah. Right?
And also because they have tons of black money, dark money pumped into them and are being propped up by like the Koch brothers, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah. I think that is kind of the legacy of Barney Fife, is, you know, the ultimate Barney meter on him is that like, he made us all kind of think that fascism is a joke and we can safely ignore those jokesters. On the other hand, and this is, you know, all Don Knotts, Barney Fife is a funny character. Like, we cannot ignore, for all of the stuff that he is a funny character. He does funny things. And sometimes I even found myself taking his side. He's a bit of a tragic character in that, like, he kind of shows what happens if, you know, you never get your feelings hurt and everybody goes out of their way to coddle you. So I think there is some tragedy to him. Overall, after 5 years of complaining about the man, I think I've come to peace that, like, I hate him, and that is what makes him a good character.
Like, yeah.
Why he deserves. And so much of that is just Don Knotts's performance.
I think Barney Fife is an accidental masterpiece of a character. I think he is the dark, I think he is the dark heart of America. Like, he is the evil of our country distilled into its purest core. And they accidentally did it by just trying to be like, hey, here's this little guy. Look how bad he sucks. And it's like, oh no, you accidentally captured it perfectly.
Yeah,
like,
what's wrong with us?
Good job.
In hindsight, like, a skinny little dipshit sheriff in the South being like the embodiment of all American evil probably shouldn't have been that surprising. Actually, we probably should have seen that coming.
Yeah. All right. So should we get it? We thought this wasn't going to be an episode, and I feel like we could have gone an episode with this. I think
this is about 30 minutes of material. This is going to be a long one. All right.
Yeah.
Let us talk about the film that inspired, kind of kicked off Don Knotts's movie star career. The Ghost and Mr. Chicken, which came out in 1966. Now, this is essentially a spinoff of the Andy Griffith Show.
Yeah.
It was directed by Alan Rafkin, who directed a bunch of episodes of the Andy Griffith Show. Fritzl and Greenbaum wrote the script. It's basically spun off of the Haunted House episode of the Andy Griffith Show. Essentially, this could be apocryphal, but the story is that Don Knotts had so much fun doing the Haunted House bits of that episode that he went to Fritzl and Greenbaum. And since they were going on hiatus pretty soon anyway, he asked them to write a screenplay where he could do more of that. Mm-hmm. So that's the birth of this movie, The Ghost and Mr. Chicken, which comes out in 1966. The title is a parody of the 1947 movie, The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, which is a like it's a romantic supernatural drama about a woman who is horny for a ghost that haunts. It has nothing to do with this other than the title. But then they made The Ghost and Mrs. Muir into a CBS sitcom or an NBC sitcom after this movie came out. So I guess we'll be doing that at some point.
Yeah. We have
to cover that.
I mean, yeah, it's a show about a lady that wants to fuck the ghost of a sea captain. Like, how can we not cover that?
But this, not,
that sounded ironic. It wasn't. I really want to find out whether or not she fucks the sea captain. We have
to do this. Hal Smith has a cameo in this movie too. Like, so this is really coming just playing Otis basically.
Yeah.
So this is really coming off of a lot just spun right out. So, at the same time though, there's some notable differences. Amazing. So let's start here. Dan, Ghost and Mr. Chicken. Do we like this movie?
Not really. I didn't really like it. I wanted to like it. I loved 15% of this movie.
The parts where he's in the haunted house?
The parts where it's the movie. I really liked the parts where this is a movie. When it's what I bought a ticket for, I love it. When it is a courtroom drama, not so much. Not that much of a fan of Ghost and Mr. Chicken, the legal thriller. Unfortunately, this movie is closer to The Pelican Brief than Ghostbusters, which I truly did not expect. But I really liked the first, second, and fifth act of this.
Let's just run through the plot real quick. We're not going to do this scene by scene. I'm going to do the plot real quick, and then we can talk about this movie in general. So in this movie, Don Knotts plays a character named Luther Heggs, who works for a newspaper as a typesetter in a small town in Kansas. And he lives in a boarding house, and he doesn't want to be in the types. He doesn't want to be in the basement anymore. He wants to be a real reporter, but nobody takes him seriously because he's the high strung, goofy Don Knotts character. He gets a quick opportunity to write some filler for the paper, and he writes about a haunted house, essentially a house that is in town that everyone knows is a murder house. There was a murder suicide there 20 years ago. And his little blurb is so popular that the newspaper editors, one of whom is Dick Sargent from Bewitched, send him to the mansion, to the old haunted house, on the 20th anniversary of those murders. So he has to be in the haunted house, in the spooky, spooky house for that period of time. The movie, the plot description should end here. I should be able to stop talking here, but I cannot. I cannot stop talking here. It continues because he is only in this house for about 9 minutes. I didn't clock it, but
the everything you should be saying after this should be antics ensue.
Right.
And then movie over. It should be 40 minutes of antics ensuing. And what happens instead of that, Marty?
So, okay, then we get a convoluted fucking mess where, okay, so he, after staying in the haunted house and witnessing some terrible ghost haunting sights, he writes an article, again, with the help of Darren Stevens. Darren, for Dick Sargent. With the help of Dick Sargent, they write an article together. The article gets very popular. It turns him into something of a local folklore hero. And then we get like 20 minutes of people celebrating him. There's a plot line about like a bunch of women in town being part of like a paranormal occult society. And the leader of that occult society is married to the bank manager. So the actual owner of the house cannot get the bank to take off the lien so that he can dispose of the house or demolish the house, which he wants to do. So the guy that inherited the house wants to demolish it. But in order to do that, he needs to get the bank to take off their lien. And now the bank will not take off the lien because the bank manager's wife is horny for spirits.
Yes. Oh, she's okay. Ghost.
Did I say that
she's
all right?
Ghost sexy. Yeah.
What a stupid fucking sentence. What a stupid sentence to describe this movie. No one in that sentence was Don Knotts. And that's stupid as hell. So then they celebrate.
We did a really bad job explaining that because explaining it is going to take 15 minutes, which is insane about this movie, The Ghost and Mr. Chicken.
I felt like I had a stroke while saying it.
Yeah.
So in order to put a stop to this, Nicholas Simmons, the bad guy of the movie, sues the newspaper for libel so that they will retract it. So the plan is to make Luther seem like he's insane. So the plan is to make him seem like he made the whole thing up and sue them for this. So then they drag this into court, and there's a very long scene of interviewing Luther's grade school teacher in order to make it seem like he was always making up stories. So now it's a courtroom drama, kind of. Yeah. It's a courtroom comedy. So we have a courtroom scene. Finally, the judge says, okay, let's go to the haunted house. So the judge and the jury and everybody go to the haunted house to see if Luther is telling the truth. Surprise, surprise, none of the haunted house stuff that he saw happens. There's no hidden passages. There's no organ playing mysterious music. And then Luther's girlfriend that he had the whole time is kidnapped by Nicholas Simmons, the guy who owns the house, because he was the one who really murdered the Simmons couple, his parents, I guess, and was wanted to tear down the mansion to, like, get rid of the evidence. It's really stupid. There's also a bald Irish guy who set this whole thing in motion, like a mysterious old man who was behind this, who is in the first bit of the movie and then fucks off, but it turns out he's really important in the last 10 minutes. And then Don Knotts karate chops a guy with his whole body at the very end. And hooray!
Yeah. Okay, so...
Except maybe there really was a ghost. Woo! All right.
That's
the ghost of Mr. Chicken, everybody.
Let's talk about... I feel like you did. I feel like you kind of land where I landed on the ghost and Mr. Chicken, right? Like, we're both kind of like, I mean, parts of it were good.
It is solid in parts. I was even, you know, I was on board with all the character introduction. I thought that was good. There was build up to it. I liked building the world around Luther. When we get to the fireworks factory, I'm like, hell yeah. Everything in the haunted house is fun. This movie needed to be like, it's a 90 minute movie. 75 of it needed to be Don Knotts bumbling around a haunted house. We get about 15 minutes cumulative. And all of that was fun. I had a great time with it. I was even on board with all of the storyline about him becoming a local hero. It's right around the time we get to like an extended scene of him at like a Chamber of Commerce picnic where he's the guest speaker and he can't really speak, that I start to slowly realize we're like at the 40 minute mark. And I start to realize, oh, we're never getting back to that house, are we?
Yeah.
We're never going back in that house. Oh God, this is the movie now.
It is really the movie pulls over to the side of the road. It just kind of stops and then it sits there and it eats a sandwich. And then after like 35 minutes, it's like, all right, we're a movie again. Come on, let's wrap this up. I want to start off by talking about the character of Luther Heggs, this Don Knotts character that is like all the not evil parts of Barney Fife.
He's just doing Barney again, right?
He's doing Barney again, but without the fascism. Like, he is... All right, so let's talk about, like, what he kept. So he kept the claims of being... of knowing karate, but he does not know karate. That, which I feel is very crucial. He's a coward still. In the name, Mr. Chicken. He is...
He does the... got it from my mother bit, the same bit that he does. And like, I think the big problem here is that the script is coming from Fritzl and Greenbaum, who are, they are decent to good sitcom writers, but even under 22 minutes, they have pacing issues, as we pointed out. You stretch that out to 90 minutes and they just don't know what to do.
Yeah.
I it's so weird. Like,
which is, it's insane that the formula that is so clear from the Andy Griffith Show and Hollywood for 20 fucking years is give Don Knotts the ball. You put him in a room, you put a couple of props in that room, you say, Don Knotts, go. And then he gets in a fist fight with a mop, he trips on a soccer ball, he does a backflip, he falls, he goes, oh boy. Like, he's just a living cartoon character. You just give him the ball. And there is so little time where he just gets to be Don Knotts. That it is insane that this is the thing that made him famous. I will say,
imagine that it's like 1988 and you have got this hot new guy, Robin Williams, in your movie. You know, you got Mork. You got Mork in this movie, and everybody's super excited for the big movie premiere of Mork from Ork. And then you let him do the spaceship thing for about 5 minutes, and the rest of the movie is about him putting saltines together to make little sandwiches and talking about how he doesn't like to be an alien for 75 minutes. That's what this would have been like.
This is my first time really seeing in his prime Don Knotts, just off the chain, doesn't have a bunch of fucking baggage that I have to deal with. And it's great. I like protagonist Don Knotts, likable dude. I like all of his, like, I'm getting really mad and I'm yelling at you and you shut up. I like that when it's not, you know, a metaphor for slowly encroaching fascism. It's pretty fun.
If anything, what this shows is how Barney Fife as a character, because he is doing Barney Fife, it shows how Barney Fife as a character is so much better if he's any other job but a cop.
Yes.
Like, if you take that same character and put him in literally any other role, you know, it's, I think we said this before, the Andy Griffith Show would have been better if they were reporters. But it's so bizarre. You give him that badge and it becomes worse. So much worse.
As soon as it has societal ramifications, that is where the problem happens.
I do think one of the things that is unusual is allowing us to actually say, hello, it's the 60s. Like, seeing Don Knotts in Technicolor, which we've seen before because we've done other Don Knotts movies. We did Limpet and we did The Love God, which came after this, et cetera, et cetera. But like the first time, like, you get that Technicolor hit of him and Fritzl and Greenbaum are allowed to like be in the 60s, the actual 60s, and they're allowed to just say words like murder and suicide, you know.
Yeah,
suddenly like quality, you know, taking off the reins a little bit does increase the outcome, the output quality substantially.
So just to circle, I want to go into the courtroom drama part of this, but to do that, we do have to do a little bit better of a job of explaining what the bad guy's deal is. So the legend of this house is that it was owned by a rich guy and his wife, and the rich guy in a fit of madness stabbed his wife to death, went upstairs, played the organ while screaming and laughing, and then threw himself to his death. In reality, his son killed them both and used a hidden staircase in the house as his alibi to like move to basically make it look like he wasn't in the house.
I cannot believe that you are explaining the house alibi thing. Continue. I was going to skip right past it, but go on.
I mean, so that's just why he wants to destroy the house. He can't because there's a lien on the house. And so he's been trying for years. He has finally convinced the bank to let him destroy the house. And as you mentioned, the bank manager's wife is mega horny for ghosts, runs the local psychic society, and also not only is like the woman that wears the pants in the relationship, big ol' air quotes with my hands, but also owns 51% of their business.
Yeah, she owns the bank. She's the majority shareholder of the bank.
Which I don't know if this was an intentional joke, but it was like, it was very much like, I'm the henpecking wife and I have all the power in the relationship. Yes, dear. I'm the cuck husband. And also I own your business. So I am actually literally the most powerful person in this relationship. Yes, dear. I'm in a vulnerable financial situation.
I honestly wish we had spent more time with this couple. Like,
yeah,
the bank manager getting cucked by ghosts is something I would have liked to spend a little more time on.
Significantly most interesting people in this. Like, I want to know everything about how they got here, about how she owns a majority of the business, about how she became a ghost fucker, about how she's constantly just out there trying to get swayzied. They're so interesting. So because she thinks about how...
I've purchased 14 pottery wheels. Yes, dear.
Wait,
you sit over there.
You watch while I get Whoopi Goldberg in here. She's going to get inhabited by the ghost of a ship captain. And we'll go sit in that stiff hotel chair.
And then the bank manager is like, oh, no, the scariest thing we can put in this movie, a black woman. Oh.
So that is the situation. He wants to destroy the house. The article inadvertently prevents him from being able to destroy the house because now it's haunted. So his solution.
It's like a tourist destination. Like the whole town is hanging up outside. And in this outside of this house that he wants to destroy for evidence. He's trying to demolish the evidence.
So his solution is to sue Don Knotts and also the paper he works for. And so they have to defend themselves.
It's been 20 years. Like, this guy was in no hurry to dispose of the evidence that he killed his family.
Like, I think you got away with it, my dude. Like, you nailed it. Like, it's cool.
It's good. Like just, nobody, just wait. It's amazing. He could have just done nothing. Like,
and he would have been so fine. He could have just let the house like continue to rot there, and nobody would have given it a second thought. Nobody was like,
I guess his concern is that people are going to want to get in because of the story, and maybe they'll discover the hidden staircase, and maybe they'll discover all the fake shit he put in there. But he's ignoring one thing. Trespassing laws. Like,
okay.
He slash the bank. Like that's where there's title law features a lot into this. There's a lot of debate over whether he actually owns the house or not. Like, to be clear, Don Knotts does not have permission. Luther does not have permission to be in there when he spends the night. He has to break in.
Yes,
he has to do a B&E.
You'd think that would be the thing that he would be suing Luther for, is you broke into my house and you wrote a story about it, so I'm suing you. You profited off of a legal entry, so lawsuit. But what instead he is suing him for is you lied about seeing ghosts, which he then has to prove in court that Don Knotts didn't see a ghost. While Don Knotts has to prove that he did see a ghost in what has to be the least doable lawsuit possible, of whether or not a guy, you can't prove either of those things. Like, nobody else was there. And it just comes down to, like, you lied about the ghost. Nuh-uh.
I believe I am not a lawyer. But I believe the burden of proof is on the accuser, right? Like, he has to prove that Don Knotts didn't see a ghost. Don Knotts doesn't actually have to prove anything, but he has to prove that Don Knotts didn't see something.
Yeah, which is, so it's just the weirdest angle, because even the judge midway through this is like, this is so stupid. And even then he's, the ultimate solution he comes on is like, well, let's just go look at the house. And if there's ghosts there, he's telling the truth. And if there's not ghosts there, then he's lying. And Don Knotts is like, yeah, let's go, man. Let's go see. Let's all go look at those ghosts. To which I would have been like, just because I saw ghosts there that time doesn't mean there's going to always be ghosts there. Otherwise, I would have probably, that somebody would have gotten to this before me. I don't know how the ghosts work. I'm not the ghost expert.
Yeah, Luther and Darren from Bewitched have a dog shit lawyer, right?
So bad.
The accused, or the accuser's entire strategy is to paint Luther as a liar. And to do that, they bring in his third grade teacher to be like, oh, well, he made up stories as a boy. Feels like you could poke holes in that argument pretty well. Like, hey, man, yeah. Hey, can I ask you something? Did any of your students ever piss their pants? When they were adults, did they continue to be pants pissers? Okay. The defense rests. Thank you.
I mean, that woman so clearly had no idea what was going on that you could have just like squined and be like, now, can you just tell me real quick, who's the president right now? And she would have been like, Howard Taft. And you could have just been like, all right, well, that's good. We're done. And the guy they bring in is just another guy who is like, who heard the organ and says he saw the ghosts. And then they just prove that he's a UFO guy. So it's like, he's discredited. He believes in UFOs. And it's like, you're arguing about whether or not there's ghosts. Like, the UFO does not discredit you in this circumstance. You are asking a guy whether or not he saw a ghost. Like, it's such a weird, Don Knotts' lawyer really should have just been like, listen, man, they haven't figured out the B&E angle on this, so let's just ride this out, and then I'll just every now and then just say, no, and I think we got this. Also, the entire building is on your side. People are like, people are like tailgating the courtroom and like have like body tattoos of Don Knotts right now. I'm liking our chances. I don't think we have to do anything. So,
and so that brings us to the haunted house itself, the big reveal. All of this was a setup by the other guy that works at the newspaper, the Irish man who we haven't really talked about this entire time.
He's a kindly Irish man.
He was the one who convinced Luther to write the thing in the first place, because he was trying to get people in to prove. What is his deal?
He starts yelling a lot of information very quickly. So he set Luther up to spend the night in the house. When Luther was in the house, he did all the stuff to make it look haunted. He played the keyboard. He moved stuff. He made it seem like there were ghosts. And he did that so Luther would write the article, so it would get a lot of attention, so the house wouldn't get demolished.
Because he's trying to prove that Nick really did kill the Simmons, because he was the only witness. Like he saw the murder 20 years ago.
Yeah. So Nick tried to set the Irish guy, who was the gardener at the time, up for the murder by stabbing her in the neck with his pruning shears. For some reason, instead of assuming that the gardener killed her, that the husband did a murder suicide. For some reason that happened. It's unclear. All of this information is being screamed by two guys, one of which has a hostage.
Yeah, so, one of which is holding a knife at a woman's throat.
Yeah. So they're just yelling all this. So it's a little unclear, but he set this whole thing in motion to some ends. Again, he's yelling it all. He's like, I did it for you, my boy. Also, fuck you. He's just kind of like, kind of cursing the guy out. He's like, and here's the why I did also eat shit. Fuck you. And again, here's another thing you did. And here's part of my scheme. And again, you son of a bitch. It's very Irish the way he handled it. He got real Irish up in here.
All right. So stuff we liked about this movie. I would say I think it sticks the landing. You know, I do think that reveal is fun and good. Like I said, I like the first little bit. It's just this drawn out middle act, the pacing of which is not good, or it's so convoluted. They run out at one point in time. They're like, I don't think we've seen Don Knotts fall down recently, so we're just going to have like a broken elevator, a scene where he has to get in an elevator and the elevator is funky.
I liked that.
I liked that, but it feels like there are other ways you could have had Don Knotts fall down, and it's part of a scene that is completely superfluous.
Yeah.
You know, to the plot. So, I mean, I like Don Knotts Don Knotts bumbling around the haunted house and making exaggerated faces and falling over and stuff. That stuff is all fun and good. That stuff is all fun.
If you want to do a bit where an elevator doesn't work very well and Don Knotts falls down trying to get into it, you know what would be a good setting to do that bit? A fucking haunted house. You know where stuff doesn't work very well? Haunted houses, famous for their poor upkeep and fixtures behaving abnormally. Yeah. I'm going to give this one thing I did like, and we haven't talked about it very much. Throughout it, Don Knotts is romancing Alma Parker, played by Joan Stanley,
mm-hmm.
who is the girlfriend, sort of, they're hanging out, of the much more successful, handsome lawyer.
Right, no, reporter. He does have
reporter.
He has kind of a workplace bully. There's this guy named Ollie at the newspaper who is like the actual reporter, who you know makes fun of Virgil. No, I keep saying Virgil, Luther. And I think they live together in the same boarding house.
They live together. So like he's just Luther's eternal tormentor because they have the same job where he is much more successful than him. They go to the same house where everybody there likes him more than him, and he is banging the woman that Luther is in love with. So he is just his like day and night tormentor. They wake up together. He's like, Luther, you stupid piece of shit. They commute to work together, and the whole time he's like, I'm living the life you wish you were. And then they go to work, and he's like, do my type, bitch boy. And then they go home and he tells a whole story to a room full of clapping people about what a piece of shit Luther is. So, but the romance that happens is, I mean, it's not like the best romance ever, but it is a portrayal of how a Don Knotts character could realistically get a beautiful woman to marry him, which is by being sweet and endearingly dumb. And eventually she just goes, you know what? This is kind of a good time.
I would say like there's no part where he is like pursuing her and she's not interested. He doesn't have to change her mind. In the movie we're going to cover next, Reluctant Astronaut, he has to change her mind. She's not into it. But in this movie, I think like she's very clearly, she invites him to lunch, right? Yeah. Like she's also just as into it, as he is. And there's even like a cute moment where he's stumbling over her words, their first kiss. He's stumbling over his words to try to talk to her. And she's like, you're saying you like me. I like you too. Kiss. And so, I mean, that's a good moment. It's a cute moment. I didn't think the romance was all that interesting in this, but you're making good points.
I like the speech he does because it is such a real, it's such a way that a guy like this would get in his head, where he's like, well, you know, like some people are like above average and some people are average. And like, you know, when like an average person knows an above average person, it's great. And like an average person is just fine. And she just goes like, you're saying you like me, which it's just like, it's just basically like he just gets stuck on the first thing he was going to say out of like eight things. But yeah, it's fucking Fritzl and Greenbaum are like being, I wouldn't say good writers in this, but they're doing good dialogue in it. The dialogue is good, you know? Like everything everybody is saying is well written and funny. It's just unfortunately happening in situations that are often pointless.
Have we talked ourselves into liking this movie?
No.
Okay. No. Fair enough.
I the thing is, I'm trying to come up with, I like all the decorations, but I don't like the house.
Fair enough.
Yeah, the central plot and structure of this movie is dumb, but all the stuff that happens in it is kind of fun.
Got it.
Yeah.
So I think that's how we feel about Ghost and Mr. Chicken, the movie that really launches Don Knotts' career and is the impetus really for him leaving the Andy Griffith Show. I don't have that much more to say about it. Any other closing thoughts on this? I would say go see Ghost and Mr. Chicken, but odds are pretty good you've seen this movie. You probably saw this movie several times in your childhood.
Yeah. I feel
like all of these were on repeat at Grandma's house.
I mean, assuming you're our age, though.
Yeah, or older, right?
Yeah.
Assuming you're in your 30s or older.
Yeah, assuming you are in your 30s, you've probably seen this movie. If you are 22 or younger, your equivalent of this was like Men in Black. Something that would make us feel fucking ancient.
All right, so the next film on the list, on the docket, I watched, you did not. So I'm going to do most of the explaining on this one. It is 1967, the very next year, The Reluctant Astronaut, starring Don Knotts and Leslie Nielsen.
Fuck! Okay, I know nothing about this movie, so I feel like a lot, is Nielsen being goofy, or is he the straight man, or is he fucking around? Is he having some fun?
The answer is yes to both. Answer is yes to both. He's definitely the straight man here, and I'll get into this later. He's having a little bit of fun being the straight man, and I'll get into this in a little bit. So let me go ahead and do the plot of The Reluctant Astronaut. So in this, Don Knotts plays a guy named Roy Fleming, who lives with his parents in a small town in Missouri, and he works as a carnival operator where he does the rocket ship ride. It's kind of like a play acting ride where he's got a fake rocket, and he takes kids in there and he does the like, oh, now we're flying over Hawaii kind of thing, like the KFC van in Community.
Right.
You know, so he's doing that. His father, who is a like shell-shocked World War One veteran.
Okay.
Hilariously shell-shocked, mind you.
Ooh, give me some examples of him having goofy PTSD.
So the way that we're introduced to this is Roy talks to his mom about the inciting incident, which is that his dad sent off an application for him to join NASA. And his mom says something to the effect of, boy, he really loves those astronauts. He loves them almost as much as he loves the war. and Don Knotts says, that war ended a long time ago. And she says, not for him, it didn't. Which would have normally, that's a tragic line, right? That's a tragic line. But no, he's just like he brings over all of his buddies and they drink and they wear like World War One like Commandant helmets. At one point in time, he's watching the TV and he's watching a he's watching like war footage. He's watching a war old war movie, and it gets interrupted by a news broadcast. And his wife is like, "Don't worry, dear. The war will still be there next Wednesday." All right, I went to IMDb. Let me give you the exact line. Roy asks, "Why is Pa always trying to run my life?" And Mrs. Fleming says, "Well, he was a corporal in World War I, and you know how bossy they were." Roy says, "But Ma, that war's been over for ages." Mrs. Fleming says, "Not to your father. He loves that war just as much today as he did then." So his shell-shocked World War I father wants to make something of his son, so he sends off an application for him to join NASA, to join the Apollo mission. I want to be clear, this movie comes out in 1967, and we will talk about the timing of this movie very soon. So we are not at the moon yet, but we are gunning for it. So he sends off an application, and they get the application back. And so NASA accepted him. He's going to go work for the space program, and everyone says he's going to be an astronaut. He's going to be an astronaut. Hey, fun thing about Roy. Roy's afraid of heights.
Okay.
So okay.
That's the, well, I mean,
hence the title. And I also had to sit there and be like, does that count as a height? I guess you're not really falling.
Yeah. I mean, I guess technically it's an omnidirectional height. You are high up from everything, but also it is the situation in which you are least likely to fall in your entire life.
There is no ground. So you're fine. You're good.
But also there is a situation in which you are falling forever. So I'm going back and forth on this. Yeah.
I had to have the same thought process as you. So like they do a bit where he like is supposed to take a plane from Missouri to Houston, where NASA is, and he sneaks off of the plane and he winds up taking a bus. He gets to NASA and he hitches a ride to where he's supposed to be from an actual astronaut, Major Fred Gifford, who is played by Leslie Nielsen. So Leslie Nielsen is like our charming, handsome astronaut hero. So he's the straight man. And you get the feeling that it's kind of like a Gilligan and Skipper situation. Like from the moment he gets in the car, Nielsen is like, "Oh, this little idiot." Like, so he's so like in a worse movie, they would be rivals. In this movie, Nielsen just kind of brings him in as like, "Oh, this guy is my little buddy." For example of this. So it is later found out that Roy was not hired to be an astronaut. He was hired to be a janitor, not just a janitor, but an assistant janitor. Like a janitor in training. So there's a really funny scene where like Leslie Nielsen and all the other astronauts are in a classroom and they're being trained by a scientist. Like, this is how the liftoff will go. And this is where, you know, you might have to worry about burning up into reentry. And then it cuts to another classroom where the head janitor is going, "This is a mop. You definitely want to clean up the floor before you mop it or you're going to have a bad..." It's very funny.
That's so much better.
I'm going to go on record and saying I think Reluctant Astronaut is a legitimately good movie. It has the same Greenbaum and Fritzl pacing problem where the second act goes way too fucking long. But it has better jokes and better performances. And there is a notable difference between Roy and Barney Fife. So I think it is just all in all a stronger movie, but it is also a longer movie by about 20 minutes, which means that fucking gap of time is extended because I've noticed this and I wrote a big thread about it over on Blue Sky on our Blue Sky account. Go follow us on Blue Sky. There is such a wild difference with these 60s Don Knotts movies between what we think the movie is about and what the movie is actually about. None of these movies want to be let them be about the thing that they're about. Right.
Right.
We mentioned this with Mr. Limpet, right? You have a fish fighting Nazis. Let the movie be about that. And what it's actually about is mostly pension plans and like the chain of command of the U.S. Navy.
It's so weird. It's always like a weird bait and switch. Because, yeah, but it's not even like it. Is it budgetary? Because
so it, I will say
they run out of interest money.
They do eventually send Don Knotts to space.
Like, good.
I am the whole time I'm screaming, send him to space already. Like, this movie should have just been Don Knotts in space, the movie.
Yeah.
But we spend so fucking long getting there. Most of the movie is about Don Knotts lying to his parents and saying that he is an astronaut when he is not, when he is a janitor. He's an astronaut. His parents think he's a janitor. He tries to tell his parents. They don't listen. And then more hijinks ensue. So a lot of it is just, and this is what I mean by the little buddy thing. For example, one time there's a scene where Leslie Nielsen meets, where Nielsen meets Roy in the locker room, meets Don. And Don says, oh, I got all sorts of problems right now, buddy. Like, you aren't going to believe what's happening. My family, blah, 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 blah. And Leslie Nielsen is kind of like, yeah, walk and talk with me. Yeah, that sounds rough, bud. Like, pats him on the back. That seems fine. What's the problem? And then while he's doing this, he's leading him into a group photo of all the astronauts in the program. And Leslie Nielsen goes, yeah, that's rough, buddy, but I'm sure that it's all going to be fine. Take the picture. Click. And so front page news is now Don Knotts holding a mop in the same line with all of these astronauts, and it goes to his family. So a good joke, good gags all around. It's
so smooth.
I tried to get you to watch this one, man. Like,
Of course, this is the one I didn't have time to watch. But sat through Ghost and Mr. Chicken, barely not fast forwarding through parts of it. And I could have been watching this rad shit, hanging out with my best friend Leslie Nielsen as a cool older brother figure.
But then, like, it goes on like this for a long fucking time. We also, like, have a whole 20-minute sequence where we go back to his family in Missouri. There's a long, like, party scene. He's called out. Don Knotts begins to do the Barney Fife thing of like, oh, actually, I'm a great astronaut. Let me tell you all the cool stuff we do. Because he starts to do the lie. And then a little kid who actually knows what, like, the space is about calls him on his shit. So we get to see, like, Don Knotts look like he's going to kill a child. This all goes on way too long. We also learn that his dad is a liar. He never saw combat in World War One. He was a librarian, which is the same backstory as Barney Fife. Yeah. But all of this eventually builds up. This takes way too long, way too fucking long, to Roy's dad and his friends doing basically Parents Day. Like, they come to NASA, like, oh, let's go take a look at Roy. Let's be tourists. And Roy has to go, oh no, and pretend that he's like wearing an astronaut suit. Like, look, Dad, this is me on a space shuttle, the lander thing. This eventually gets Roy fired because he launches himself out of a rocket car in order to impress his dad, which means basically Don Knotts standing in front of a green screen making faces like he's going, whoa, 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 in a rocket car. It's a great, great introduction. That is funny. And I'm sitting there going, let Don Knotts do more of this.
Yeah.
So much of it is just like pretending to be an astronaut. So he gets fired. And then we get to my favorite scene in the entire movie. This is a testament to how good Leslie Nielsen is, because the hardest I laughed in this whole movie, Don Knotts is not even in the scene. And Leslie Nielsen isn't even doing anything. But we finally get to the setup for Roy being launched into space. There's a secret NASA meeting, and all the NASA officials say, listen, we just got word about the Russians sending up an automated spacecraft. And they say that it's so good, this automated spacecraft, that they're not sending an astronaut. They're not sending a pilot. They think literally any citizen. They're sending a dentist. They're sending a dentist up to go into space with this automated, to show how good it is, to show that any Russian citizen can operate it like a car. And they go, we need a layman of our own. We need a big fat moron. We need an absolute idiot. We need a real dipshit to send into space to beat the Russians, to show that we can send them an even dumber guy. And while they're saying this, it just, Nielsen just sits in his chair thinking about this, just pondering the words. He doesn't even say anything until he finally goes, I got a guy. It's so fucking funny watching Leslie Nielsen. Just go and watch this. It's so funny watching Leslie Nielsen ponder his idiot friend for a minute. He's not doing anything, but it's the hardest I laughed at the entire movie.
How? Because he started out as like a hard boiled straight actor. I have a deep voice. I'm a handsome man. I got a fine head of hair. How crazy
absolutely
do you
the
think
kind
it
of
was?
Guy you would hire to be an astronaut.
Yeah. Like, how crazy do you think it was? I'm definitely slowly figuring out that he's a comedic genius of going from like, oh, he's a little funny. He's kind of like Cary Grant. He's a funny dude. Oh wait, no, he's really funny. Oh my God. He is not supporting a comedic actor. He is comedic actor. Oh my God. He's funnier than that. Holy shit.
I think we can see this in real time. I think we've been seeing this development with Channing Tatum.
Yeah.
Like very recently, finding out that Channing Tatum is funnier than we thought, and actually just like funnier than most of actual comedians. We just kind of passed over him because he's incredibly handsome as well.
Yeah.
Gosling, I think, is another example. Like, I think we see guys like this now, but now it's almost like part of their trajectory. Leslie Nielsen was like 60 before this. So Leslie Nielsen says, I got a guy, right? They go to find him, Roy, who has by this point been doing Jaeger bombs in a bar called the Launch Pad for like 4 hours. So he is pissed drunk. And they convince him to come back and be an astronaut for America. They take him up in a jet. He accidentally hits the ejector seat. Finally, we get Don Knotts in space. They launch him up into orbit, and he's in an orbiter. And this whole sequence is very charming. It's, you know, they do a little bit of the like Homer Simpson thing where he opens a box of crackers and the crackers fly everywhere. You can still see the wires that are hanging the crackers. It's pretty fun. He does a little bit of wire work where he falls out of his chair and then has to spin around. Probably the best bit is when he finds like a tube of peanut butter for his crackers, and he shoots it all out, and it just comes out like a peanut butter snake, like a toothpaste. And then they play Snake Charmer music as the peanut butter tube falls around his head. Like, it's all good. It's all funny. This whole bit is good and solid.
I wasn't going to watch this movie, you should have screamed at me. You should have said, when I said I don't have time to watch this one, you should have said, make time.
I told you it was good. I like this movie, but it does. That's my biggest complaint. It does have those same Fritzl and Greenbaum pacing problems. And that's it. He's eventually comes back a hero. And it's good. I like this movie a lot. Now, let me tell you a little bit about the release of the Reluctant Astronaut.
Ooh.
Yeah. The release of The Reluctant Astronaut is released on January 25th, 1967 in Houston. 2 days later, the Apollo 1 rocket explodes on the launch pad at Cape Canaveral and kills 3 astronauts.
Holy shit!
This movie does not do very well. And Universal does not know how to promote a movie about this at this point in time. Remember, this is Apollo 1. So now everyone's like, oh shit, is this space thing going to happen at all?
So, yeah, maybe this wasn't such a good idea. Maybe we shouldn't be trying this out. Which, much less of a problem for for Russia, where they were just like, yeah, we're just gonna fill the stratosphere with dead bodies until eventually one of them works.
Send up, like, as many dogs as we can. Like,
yeah, like, just keep trying until, like, there are so many Russian dog corpses just floating over our heads all the time.
Like, this is 3 days later, NASA's like, does anybody know Stanley Kubrick's phone number?
Yeah.
Get him in here. So yeah, amazingly bad timing on this movie.
Which, I think at one point Russia was like four astronauts, like, cooked like they were in an oven during re-entry. And Russia was just like, re-entry hot. Make hull thicker. And it was like, they just opened like a shuttle and were like, welcome back to Earth. Oh no.
You know, as they say in Russia, you cannot make omelet without killing several monkeys. I don't have that much else to say about this movie. It's good. It's really good. I don't know why 1960s and 70s Don Knotts movies are not about the thing that they are about, but this one does eventually get there, and the payoff is good.
Every movie from this era has a built-in 40 minutes for you to go out into the theater and make some phone calls. Like, it really feels like it is almost intentionally boring for a period of time.
Like, right now we have an app that tells you when to go out to pee long movies like Avatar, which, by the way, fuck you if you use that. Just sit there. You hold your bladder for a little bit. Jesus Christ.
Or just go pee during one of the 15 establishing shots of fish. Like, you're not going to miss it. They're going to show you the fish again. Don't worry about it. Go take a piss.
Oh, man. That was exactly what James Cameron said, right? James Cameron, fucking Babe Ruth calling the shot, was like, go piss. You're going to see the movie again. It's Avatar, bitch. You
know, yeah.
But like you do that now and you have, you know, 15 seconds. Like, go now. Go. Get it out. Okay. Shake it. Okay. Put it away. Guess what? More exposition's happening now. You're going to miss some shit.
Like, Dune 2 was very much like, I sprinted to the bathroom and I, like, got back just in time to not lose complete track of the plot. Like, somebody was like, all right, I'm going to, and here's the end of this crucial exposition that explains the next 45 minutes. Meanwhile, like, all movies from the 60s were like, all right, I'm gonna, for the next 5 minutes, just name animals I can think of while staring off into space. Tiger. Porcupine. And it's like, all right, time to go. Sloth. Giant sloth.
So yeah, this movie's good. I think in an alternate universe where the Apollo 1 didn't blow up, that I think this would have been a bigger success and probably remembered a little better, and probably would have eclipsed Ghost and Mr. Chicken. And this would be the one that airs constantly. And, you know, we see is more entrenched in our minds. Cause it's a better movie by every measure.
Yeah.
So just the worst timing imaginable.
So in summary, if NASA weren't such a bunch of dipshits, the media landscape would be better. So like first try, you blow it on Apollo 1. God, you fucking losers.
So that is it. That is our send off to Don Knotts. The naughty boy himself is out and he's gone. I want answers. I want to know what happened in 1965. I want to hear about this.
We're going to have to read a Don Knotts biography, which we should have done a while ago.
There are books called Andy and Don. The problem is, and I'll mention this in the next episode, but the problem is every time I try to read about the production of this, every time I try to read something about this, it's just such a, like, hagiography. I don't know if that's, I'm saying that right, but it's just like a look at how great this was, and or it's just like trivia. It's just like behind the scenes facts about the Andy Griffith Show, which I don't care about. Really, yeah. Really, Evan's book, Evan Dalton Smith's book, is the first book about the Andy Griffith Show that I've seen that did any analysis whatsoever about it. But maybe, yeah, maybe if there is a Don Knotts biography, I think there is one called Andy and Don Will Read. This is useless.
This is, I mean, all of these were like the era of Andy Griffith and Don Knotts, like in this period, was like back when every ounce of Hollywood was through like 40 pounds of fixers. So it was all like you're not going to get any actual reality of what it was like to make these shows, because as soon as a reporter started to talk to Andy Griffith, somebody shot them in the head. So yeah, you're just only getting the Hollywood, bright lights, the big city, showbiz town, making dreams happen. Like that's all you're going to get.
It is mentioned that Andy Griffith himself did have an opportunity. Like, he had a chance to get in on this. They wanted to do like a Bob Hope and Bing Crosby kind of thing, or like a Martin and Lewis kind of thing. So he could have written Don's coattails, and Andy could have had a film career too, but he would have had to have played the Dean Martin role and just kind of buddy this thing. And I think he thought initially like, no, fuck that. Understandably.
Andy Griffith pretty clearly wanted to play bad guys after the Andy Griffith Show. Like he wanted to have edge and be scary. Like he wanted to be the opposite of Andy Griffith. That's why he made like a bunch of shitty TV movies where he was a complete bastard. That's why he made Savages. Like, I think he just really did not want to be Andy Taylor anymore. While Don Knotts was perfectly happy to continue to be Barney Fife.
Yeah, Don Knotts was like, you want me to do the face? I'll do the face. Whoa! Okay, yeah. Now back up the truck of money, asshole.
Like, yeah, well, Don Knotts' job was way more fun, where it was like, you'd be this wacky guy who does like falls and says like, ooh, I'm freaking out. And meanwhile, it's like, all right, Andy Griffith, can you be our dad? Can you be our dad and make us feel like nothing bad is ever going to happen? And maybe like you can tell a joke if you want, but most importantly, can you be our dad? And he's like, fuck this. I'm going to go be horny in the desert. Like this sucks shit.
That's it. You nailed it. I think that's a good note for us to close on. Goodbye, Don. We'll miss you probably.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to miss you real fucking fast, Mr. Knotts. I think
your replacement is going to be bleak.
By all accounts, your replacement is a nightmare. So, don't go. No, go. Get out of here.
Happy trails. We'll see you all down at the fishing hole. Boom, 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 boom